drop off plastic bags and wrap, household recycling, and even food scraps. Recycle these items and more at the Ramsey County Environmental Center in Roseville. Visit RamseyRecycles.com/EC to learn more and get directions. That's RamseyRecycles.com/EC.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. This is your host for today, Dave Gutnecht. Don Olson had an appointment and will be back with me next week. And thanks to Miguel here at KFAI for support in the studio. Today I'll bring lots of comments from several sources and we'll cover as much ground as we can. I'll be focusing on the background to war plus updates and possible outcomes. So let's jump right into it. First, some large-scale perspective comments of my own. And then we'll get into quoting some other folks. I believe the conflicts in Ukraine and Iran are long-term and will remain unresolved. Sadly, wars are to a significant extent waged to extend control over commodities and financial resources. The current U.S. wars are deeply entrenched and likely to be prolonged. What's the ideological and institutional basis of the Ukraine war? 4 years ago, in the book group with Don and other friends, I warned that the Ukraine war with Russia would force people to think about geopolitics, an unpleasant enough outlook at those who plan and provoke wars, wage illegal and cruel sanctions that kill millions, sponsor numerous coups and their accompanying propaganda narratives. Here's an example of U.S. imperial grand visions. It's background, all this recent background from 1990s. I've got a very thick book here titled Provoked, How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. It's by Scott Horton. And here's a paragraph he had in his foreword. There was a debate among certain conservatives and neocons about how much we should push our newfound global dominance. And two of them were named Krauthammer and Kirkpatrick. As Krauthammer put it in his rejoinder to Kirkpatrick in The National Interest, denouncing the more conservative Russell Kirk and Pat Buchanan, who urged a return to normalcy, the U.S. now ruled, quote, a super sovereign West, economically, culturally, and politically hegemonic in the world. I suggest we go all the way and stop at nothing short of universal domination, unquote. He later added, we are living in a unipolar world. We Americans should like it and exploit it, unquote. No, really, our politicians insist it's all for the world's good. Keeping the peace, spreading democracy, protecting the sea lanes, and enforcing the, quote, global rules-based liberal international order, unquote. But it takes an empire to do it. So that's our recent legacy in this country, and I believe that's still a ruling outlook among many, many people in the United States. To reiterate the financial and ideological outlook, recently Treasury Secretary Bessent said the U.S. must control the oil trade to protect the dollar. Think oil in Venezuela, in Iran, in Russia. Along with seizure or freezing of assets of those countries, another blatantly illegal act. And the U.S. is also trying to control key sea lanes globally. Exceptionalism is an adolescent notion for an adolescent nation. And now we have an adolescent president who reacts impulsively with rage and insults when things don't go his way. Meanwhile, economic disaster looms for the U.S. and the West with the renewed closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Reviewing some specifics, and we'll get to the current drama. As I mentioned last week, U.S. and Israel lost a 12-day war of June last year because Iran's military capacity proved much stronger than had been anticipated, and ours was probably overestimated. And again this spring, February 28th, the next attack, having used the period since June to prepare for more war, the outcome was further damage to the U.S. and Israel, and again demonstrating Iran's resilience and increasing its control of the Strait of Hormuz. So the U.S. lost that round of the war also. The Memorandum of Understanding is dead. U.S. refuses to exercise its power and ability to restrain Israel in Gaza and West Bank and Lebanon. Israel violations of the MOU and its killing and destruction in Lebanon continue. So Rubio and the U.S. betrayed the MOU immediately in Lebanon. A weak Lebanon government surrendered to Israel. But Hezbollah is a very large civic and political part of Lebanese society, not to be destroyed despite Israel's genocidal intent. Trump and the U.S. have shown no willingness to stop Israel's Lebanon attack. Meanwhile, the U.S. thinks it can, quote, restock on oil, as just stated by Vice President Vance, a superficial strategy given other constraints. Here we have, for the umpteenth time, especially in the Mideast, the U.S. using the pretext of negotiations to prepare for more war, even to assassinate the negotiators. So there's lots more comments. There's some good stuff in the Duran, which is a site I recommend for current news and analysis. And at the NATO summit, the Mideast crisis overshadowed Ukraine. So I'll have more comments on both the Ukraine scenario and Iran. But the recent gathering was probably somewhat disappointing because they're running out of missiles, Patriot interceptors for Ukraine and for other scenarios. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov argued just 2 days ago that the fighting could end immediately if Ukraine accepted Russia's territorial demands, a proposal Kiev has consistently rejected. Meanwhile, the U.S. and its European pro-war lackeys warn, quite implausibly, that Russia is planning to invade Poland to test NATO. Quite ridiculous, really, in my opinion. Finland and Lithuania, meanwhile, are moving to allow nuclear weapons on their territory for the first time. My question, in light of that, from which direction is the military threat? And here's some more from Eve Smith. I've cited her before at nakedcapitalism.com. Quite informed and astute commentary. She's from the U.S. but is based in Thailand. Quote, we warned from the outset that this conflict would be a test to destruction. The U.S. will not accept Iran controlling the Strait of Hormuz, even though it lacks the military means to change that, except possibly nuclear weapons. So Trump, who thinks the solution to any problem is more punishment, is doubling down. In the last 24 hours, Trump delivered on his threat to make even bigger strikes in response to the latest set of exchanges. Iran has retaliated, but has not yet acted on his threat to again close the Strait of Hormuz, although traffic has collapsed due to the exchanges this week. So Iran may be holding back or playing that card formally. We'll be returning to some of the geopolitics of Strait of Hormuz when we hear from Professor Mirandi later. But for now, here's a couple more, and then we'll get to Patrick Henningsen, a good commentator. So one more bit from Eve Smith about U.S. steps toward wider war. In the face of renewed U.S. determination to prove its manhood, it seems likely that Iran will also engage in non-kinetic escalation, such as enriching uranium to 90% and or enlisting Ansar Allah to attack shipping in the Bab el-Mandab Strait, which leads to the Red Sea. That may not amount to a full closure, but will come close enough for the purpose of reducing oil shipments. So again, my friends, there's economic crisis looming. This is why we stopped the second round of the war. That is the one that started February 28th, and this is still overhanging all of Trump's and our planners' decisions. The U.S. seems unable to comprehend that it lacks the means to break Iran control of the Strait of Hormuz before Iran breaks the global economy and the U.S. with it. I think that's a summary of the whole current situation. Iran has tremendous leverage, and there's no clear way out militarily. Now I'm going to go to Patrick Henningsen. You know, there are actually a good number of journalists in Iran. You just have to seek them out. You won't find them in the mainstream, but Patrick Henningsen, Max Blumenthal, Pepe Escobar, and a good number of others can be found out there on Substack, on YouTube, and other places on the web. So interviewed on the Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis show is Patrick Henningsen, who was recently there and has some interesting comments.
Which is the first time on record that had been hit. It was over 3,000 kilometers. So that is causing some significant problems with Russia. Apparently, there's a overall all these recent strikes are causing Russia quite a bit of problems in refinement capacity, and it's causing them to actually have to start rationing fuel even inside of Moscow and in other parts of Russia. Meanwhile, on the eve of the NATO meeting tomorrow, I think is when it starts, Ukraine is saying, hey, we need more patriots. Don't give it to us in 2027, which apparently is some contracts. They want a bunch now. Of course, it's not really going to make that much difference, but that's what they're trying to say. And lastly, President Trump is saying, hey, Trump won spending promises from NATO last year, and this year he's going to try to enforce them here. How do you see all of this stuff playing out as on the eve of the NATO summit, where Ukraine wanting to get a bunch more stuff, Trump wanting to tell NATO, give me more money or spend more money, and then Russia and Ukraine continuing to back and forth on the energy attacks?
Yeah, Danny, you just cracked the Enigma code of the Ukraine conflict. That's like on the eve of every single major, whether it's the G7, NATO summit, Munich Security Conference, you see these gallant Ukrainian drone attacks. And really, the way these are regarded in Russia are they're an annoyance, they're really inconvenient, but ultimately they're a series of pinpricks compared to the bigger strategic picture. And again, this is like very, it might seem like canny tactical maneuvers by the Ukrainians and their European backers, but what are they really going to achieve in the long run? Because on the battlefield in Ukraine, Russia still plays the long game. They have now breached some of the most key fortress cities. And they have total control over Luhansk. That's a major achievement and a major initial objective of the original SMO. And they're very close to doing that in Donetsk as well. So in terms of Donbass and also some of the key fortifications that were protecting Kharkiv as well, and as well Odessa won't be far behind. So those are the sort of long-term strategic objectives of Russia of securing its perimeter. And so they're going to achieve these things whether or not these refineries keep getting hit by Ukrainian drone attacks. So Ukraine might be winning the media war. They might be winning the fundraising war vis-a-vis NATO funding and the support from Western allies, but they're losing the actual war on the ground in Ukraine. That's pretty clear from pretty much all the reports that we can find and all the data we're looking at. And again, the Jack Keens of the world will go and wax on Fox saying, well, look how long it's taken Russia to take such little territory. They must not be very good and very effective. Putin's on his last legs. Russia's on their knees. Well, a little bit of common sense. Clearly, there's nation building going on here on the Russian side. They're recapturing historic Novorossiya that pretty much overlays pretty clear with the Ukrainian electoral map vis-a-vis Russian speakers voting for pro-Russian candidates. And they plan on governing over these areas. Now, Danny, as a military expert yourself, you'll know that if you plan on governing and taking territory and keeping territory, the last thing you want to do is be killing civilians in those territories. That means the grind is going to be slow, it's going to be tedious, it's going to be meticulous, and you yourself are going to incur quite a few losses on the Russian side in doing that. But while doing that, they're also wiping out massive amounts of Ukrainian battalions, and they're overcoming a lot of the tactical things that Ukraine has been throwing at Russia over the last 4 years. I'm not saying this is pretty. I'm not saying that this is a clean war for either side, but it's very clear what the Russian strategy is. However, I'm not very sure what the Ukrainian strategy is, or the U.S. or the European strategy in that sense.
It seems to just be continue the war and just keep the thing going, no matter how many Ukrainian people have to die, because it seems that that is an end unto itself to keep the thing going. But the problem is that there has been an increasing number of statements and annoyance and aggravation, if not outright anger, on the Russian side because of strikes like this, which now have an impact on the population. I think that there is this fantastical hope among the Western that somehow this annoyance with Putin can turn into people turning against him and saying, hey, just end the war right here. Do you see any prospect that that could happen?
Absolutely not. Despite how painful and uncomfortable this conflict is for many Russians, let's not kid ourselves, it is. But a bigger majority of the Russian population is absolutely behind the government. They know, like the Iranians know, this is a bigger story. This is an existential threat to Russia. NATO enlargement, the weaponization of Ukraine, all the schism that they're trying to create between Ukrainians and Russians in the West, just as the Iranians are also very aware that this is an existential drive to eliminate any resistance to U.S. or Israeli hegemony in the Middle East. The same is true with Eastern Europe and along this front. Everybody knows that. Hence, Danny, the support, the deep support's there. But what's more important, the institutions in Russia are going to support the president. And Putin, even if he's losing 5, 6, 7, let's say he lost 10% on approval poll ratings and stuff like that, he's still, you know, very comfortably around 70% approval rating. And, you know, compare that to any leader anywhere else in the world. I'd say Vladimir Putin's in a very good standing in that sense. So, again, if they're hoping that this is going to somehow pull the rug out from under the Russian president, what they're doing. And in fact, it is galvanizing the hardliners. The hardliners in Russia are getting a better platform now. That's not good news for the West. I'm sorry. It just isn't. So I think they need to reevaluate their, quote, strategy on this.
And what do you mean?
There again is Patrick Henningsen on the Daniel Davis Show. And I'm sorry I didn't introduce that properly because I wanted to get to his point about there's parallels with Ukraine and Iran. And I had been speaking about Iran, where we also have the population, rather than being upset with their government, has rallied behind. I mean, we just saw one of the biggest events of our lifetime with millions and millions honoring the Ayatollah and family in Tehran for several days straight. Many, many millions, one of the largest funerals ever seen in human history. So what our attacks have done is solidify a lot of the population around backing their government. And similarly, there's a lot of propaganda narrative around Ukraine is winning or can win and that Russia is losing. We get this a lot with not a lot of great evidence once you look into it. But the U.S. enabled strikes, that is, enabled by our satellite reconnaissance and our excellent advice and our technology and all and so on. It's not just Ukraine. The U.S. attacks and the Western sponsored attacks on Russia are achieving propaganda points and, as mentioned by the speaker, are hurting Russian oil economy. Yet it's not altering the Ukraine war basics except strengthening, as mentioned, Russian resolve and its response. The U.S. recognizes it cannot win militarily, so now I believe it hopes to make Russians suffer to the point of undermining public support for the war. But most Russians know that the stakes are existential for them, unlike for most Americans, and many of them have expressed a desire to escalate and subdue the Western-backed Kiev regime. Even pro-Western Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky spoke about how Russian society has settled into three chief groups, 15% pro-Westerners, 15% war beneficiaries who want Putin to go even harder against Ukraine, and 70% of the main population who do not want the war, who do want the war to end, but only on Russia's terms. Meanwhile, important footnote here, a Ukrainian defense ministry site was hacked recently, and the files it revealed showed records of 2.4 million Ukrainians either dead or, quote, missing. Again, Russia is advancing, but behind the ploys about negotiations, the U.S., especially the CIA, are escalating. New York Times itself reported 6 months ago that the CIA was continuing and increasing its support for Ukrainian attacks into Russia. Worth looking that up, because while Trump and Hegseth were making noises about cutting back a little bit, the CIA was rushing and expanding its intelligence sharing and enabling these increased threats inside Russia. Now, the report continues, the agency honed a plan to at least buy time to make it harder for the Russians to capitalize on the Ukrainians' extraordinary moment of weakness. That's a few months ago, but that continues to today. One powerful tool finally employed was ATACMS, and targeting intelligence for strikes against Russia was pulled from the table, but a parallel, again, managed by the CIA, was sharing targeting intelligence and other assistance for these drone strikes against crucial components of the Russian defense and energy systems. So back to my own comments, and then we'll get to Doug McGregor on the Daniel Davis Show. So the conclusion from that to me is, after initial failure, the CIA began to coordinate even more deeply with Ukrainian counterparts, resulting in greater successes, at least on the narrative propaganda front. And here comes the clincher. New York Times admits that the CIA was essentially responsible for entirely crafting the new strategy, and with Trump's permission to boot. Now here's Douglas McGregor on Daniel Davis Show, another military veteran. We got about 5 minutes from him. He's a frequent commentator on this program. Let's see. Okay.
Here, what do you think of that idea?
Well, he's also mentioning something else that I think is worth noting. In the context of what he was discussing, he was saying, what is wrong that the Western world is not adequately mobilized, its industry, its capabilities, its forces, to support me, Zelensky? Now, you know, I've never been a supporter of this man. He, like everything else associated with the Ukrainian war, is a fraud. I mean, this is someone, Kolomoisky, a famous Jewish oligarch from Russia, who then moved into Ukraine and established himself and made billions. He's now, I guess, sitting in jail somewhere. He's the one that found Zelensky, who grew up speaking only Russian, who was a comedian, not a Ukrainian ethnically, and certainly not by birth, and puts him in charge of Ukraine, with the help, of course, of the Newlands and Kagans and others. Now, these people created this fictitious government, and we have been backing it to the hilt, thanks to the CIA and the United Kingdom's MI6. And he's saying, look, you put me here. I was willing to try and get out of this with a peace agreement. You sent in Boris Yeltsin. He promised me the world. You haven't delivered. And what he's really saying is, if you don't give me everything now, I'm not going to be here in another year. And he's correct. He is absolutely correct. Now, there's something else that is never mentioned. That is that President Putin has exercised enormous restraint. He's always been opposed to any action that might result in the sudden introduction of NATO forces into the equation. He doesn't want a major war. He's handled that very well. But things are getting rough right now in this war, in the sense that the Russian people certainly have run out of patience. But we need to remember that President Putin also has enormous influence in Venezuela, in Cuba, even in Mexico. He has enormous amount of influence in many countries. He could escalate the conflict that we've got going right now in Ukraine against him, and for that matter, what we're doing in the Middle East to destroy Iran, and move this horizontally into the Western Hemisphere. We are lucky that we've got President Putin on the other side of this equation. The problem is, somewhere along the line, President Trump seemed to promise some degree of flexibility, understanding, or agreement in Alaska. That turned out to be a complete and utter fraud. And I think that's begun to really change the situation and the attitude in Moscow towards us. It's not simply we can't believe in anything the Americans say. They're really the enemy too, just as much as the people in Europe. I think that's very dangerous, and that's why it is not impossible that we could see dramatic events over the next several months. The assumption that the Russians will sit quietly, gradually bite off pieces of their enemy. There, now we've got these fortress cities that are falling, but not move beyond that, I think is a mistake. I think it's very dangerous. This is a more dangerous period right now than perhaps any that we've seen to this point. So I don't know which particular conflict blows up in our faces first, whether it's Iran or Ukraine, and I don't exclude trouble in the Caribbean with Cuba and Venezuela and Mexico. But nobody seems to be focused on any of those things. Nobody sees any connectivity between those things. And we really ought to. There's more going on than we realize, and we don't have control over what's happening in our own country. And that's another matter. We haven't even talked about economics. And you can bring on Jeff Curry, who knows more about the oil market and oil trade than anybody, but you can bring on any number of people beyond him. No one can predict with absolute certainty, but we know we're headed for an emergency set of circumstances between now and the fall in the oil markets. That's going to have an impact here at home as well. Is anybody really thinking that through, or is President Trump absolutely convinced that he can simply manipulate these markets in perpetuity because we're running out of the oil to do it? Now, maybe that'll change and, you know, sun will break through and suddenly all the bad weather will go away. I don't know, but I think there are too many variables. There's too much potentially bad that could go wrong. But no one seems to tie that together in any sort of meaningful way.
No, and it's something that's just not.
That again is retired Colonel Douglas McGregor on the Daniel Davis program. And McGregor actually served high up in the first Trump administration, but he has very strong disagreements with the current Trump administration and its policies. But you see what a juggling act I'm trying to do here, because there's two wars, very important theaters going on at once. One is a grinding war of attrition where we're running short of air defense missiles. And the other one in West Asia, where Iran has tremendous leverage economically over the course of events. So I'm going to return to Professor Mirandi in a minute here, who's an Iranian voice and quite articulate. But one other paragraph first to, again, give context to some of what's going on in Iran and West Asia. This is from Professor Robert Pape, who is at University of Chicago, just down the hall, as it happens, from Professor Mearsheimer, but he has somewhat different points of view. And he's commenting frequently online, and here's a recent paragraph from him. After witnessing one of the largest funerals in history, many millions over several days this week for Ayatollah Khamenei and others in Tehran, Professor Pape comments, leaders who might previously have worried about the domestic cost of prolonged confrontation have now witnessed an extraordinary public demonstration of nationalist solidarity. That makes it easier, not harder, to demand more, he means on the part of the Iranian rulers. Everyone is watching shipping in Hormuz. What actually matters is Iran's demands. The consequences extend far beyond Tehran. It means harder Iranian negotiating demands are now more likely, just as the global economy approaches its most vulnerable period. The next 2 to 3 weeks may determine whether August brings elevated energy prices or a genuine global economic shock. The strategic question is no longer whether U.S.-Iran talks eventually resume. It is whether the political conditions now exist for Iran to press for substantially greater concessions, precisely when time is beginning to work in its favor. And now, for a few minutes, let's see, this is a little longer, about 10 minutes, from Professor Mirandi, who's in Iran, literature and Orientalism and other related studies. He actually was educated in the U.S., so his English is really excellent. He's on the Neutrality Studies Show. The host there is Pascal Lataz, who comes from Switzerland, which has a long, glorious history of neutrality, but of course now it's in the course of abandoning it, like a number of other countries. Pascal Lataz is a Swiss operating out of Japan, so an interesting international perspective. So here he's interviewing quite recently Professor Syed Marandi.
Pretending to at least, or dragging their feet at the, while dragging their feet, they abide by some of their commitments. So, for example, the siege on the Strait of Hormuz has been lifted by the Americans. And the reason is that if they impose the siege, Iran will also impose a ban on ships moving through the Strait of Hormuz. That's the only reason why the Americans have lifted the siege. And if the Americans refrain from carrying out their commitments, as we are seeing by not handing over Iranian assets, by trying to undermine Iran's authority over the Strait of Hormuz, by allowing the Israeli regime to carry out slaughter, then the Iranians will be able to slow down the pace in which ships pass through the Strait. And that, of course, puts pressure on Trump and the U.S. economy. So at the moment, the U.S. is in violation. And it's not in American interests. If you recall, Trump himself, when he was trying to justify why he signed the MOU, he said that our energy reserves are very low and there are only 4 weeks left. So based on that assessment and that admission by Trump, you would imagine that he would be very keen on fulfilling his side of the bargain. But then again, if you look at things objectively, you have the Israeli regime, you have the Zionist lobby in the United States, and they do not want this deal to be implemented. They want to be able to continue bombing Lebanon, to occupy and annex the southern part of the country. And they do not want tensions to ease between Iran and the United States at any level. So they are continuing to put pressure on Trump. And that is why we see the Americans violating the deal in so many respects.
Right. But it seems to me that with the Strait of Hormuz, Iran has actually found a serious pain point of the United States. And is it in that case correct to look at it now as, Iran is moving towards a situation where it's not about open or close, not a binary of the Strait of Hormuz, but more like a faucet. You're like, let go through more or less, depending on whether the Americans behave according to the MOU, which in my view is at this point a kind of a yardstick for Iran, right? It's a way to a measuring tape in order to assess whether the U.S. is living up to its commitments or not. And if they don't, then you just go back to punishing the U.S. with what word actually hurts. Is that what's going on?
Exactly. That was very well put. If the United States abides by its commitments in accordance with the agreement, then the Strait of Hormuz is normalized. And if the United States refuses to abide by its commitments, depending on the degree to which it refuses to do so, then the Iranians will be able to limit the number of ships that pass through the Strait. Of course, Iran also has another form of leverage, and that is the nuclear program. The Iranians have said that if the United States does not abide by its commitments, we're never going to get to negotiations over a final deal with regards to the Iranian nuclear program and the broader sanctions regime. So if Trump wants a deal over the nuclear program, he has to abide by his commitments. If Trump wants the flow of energy and other resources to pass, to go through the Strait of Hormuz like it was 5 months ago, then he's going to have to abide by his commitments. Otherwise, he's going to drag down his economy and the global economy with it.
Hey, just a very quick note. The best way to support this channel is by signing up.
It's a brief interruption by Pascal Lataz. I forgot that's in the middle there. We'll be right back in just 5 or 10 seconds here.
The question to me about the nuclear agreement that Trump says he wants is like, does he mean that? I mean, it, from everything that happened since 2018, it seems to me that that was always a convenient talking point, but that they actually don't care. I mean, this is something to dangle in front of the Iranians in order to make them jump over all hoops. But actually, I mean, it seems to me that that really doesn't hurt them very much, whereas the Strait of Hormuz now actually really honestly does. And you're now, Iran is now in the position where it can condition the United States, condition them during the war by saying, like, if you hurt us, we'll hurt you back, and it will hurt for real until they got it. And now it seems that Iran is working on doing that again, saying, like, well, if you don't live up to your promises, we're going to hurt you again, like Pavlov with his dogs, right? So, but the nuclear deal, do you believe the Americans actually want it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, You're absolutely correct. Ultimately, if Trump can't get a nuclear deal, he'll just change the topic and talk about something else. He'll move on. That's what he does. When he fails with regards to the tariff war, he shifts gear and moves somewhere else. And when he fails against Iran in the war, he changes the topic and moves somewhere else. And his base usually follows him. Most Americans don't. But his base will continue to follow him no matter where he goes, at least for the time being. However, the Strait of Hormuz is different. And if the Strait of Hormuz is not open and if trade is not normalized, then we're heading for disaster. And that is the only reason why he agreed to the MOU in the first place, because he failed in the war, he failed at siege warfare, and he literally had no option but to accept the MOU, which was very favorable to Iran, because of those failures. And now, again, because of the pressure from the Zionist lobby, the Israeli regime, especially over Lebanon, but also on all these other issues, he is trying to refrain from carrying out his commitments, yet his expectation is that the Iranians will abide by theirs. And that's just not going to happen, as we've seen during the last 24, 36 hours.
It's quite fantastic now that the United States still operates under the assumption that they're free to do whatever they want, and the consequences will be suffered by others, because Iran figured out a way to make that not another reality. But what's your assessment about the Gulf states now? One of the things that surprised me is that some of the negotiations, follow-up negotiations, are actually happening in Qatar. Because, yeah, Qatar isn't exactly on good terms with Iran either. However, we are also seeing other Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, that sent a delegation to the funeral of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. What's happening there?
Well, you know, when you were speaking about the United States ignoring its commitments, I was reminded of a speech that I think it was Clinton who once said that the United States always abides by its commitments unless it doesn't. And so they're above the law, and that's American exceptionalism. And in fact, There's some striking similarities between American exceptionalism and Zionism, and that they are above and beyond everyone else. So if someone else does not abide by their commitments, they can be punished, they're rogue. But if the United States does not abide by its commitments, that's because they feel that it is necessary to choose a different route. So for them, anything that they do is legitimate, including the war in Iraq, among other things, and now the war against Iran. But if anyone else violates a deal, they are condemned, and the Western media will declare them to be rogue and a threat to the international law and order. But the situation in the Persian Gulf is actually quite fluid, I think, with regards to relations with between Iran and those five countries that assisted the United States in the war. There has been one-on-one negotiations with these five countries, and there has been progress, especially, I think, with so far, and things could change very swiftly, but with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Emirates. And you've noticed, obviously, that during the past few weeks, every time that the Americans would violate the ceasefire and strike Iran, Iran would retaliate by striking U.S. assets in Kuwait and Bahrain, but not in Saudi Arabia, not in Qatar, and not even in the Emirates. And this is reflective of the fact that progress has been made in the bilateral negotiations between Iran and these three different countries. But it is still a very fluid situation, because on the one hand, you have the Americans who are undermining the MOU. And so, for example, it is pushing tankers from these countries to ignore the MOU and to pass through the U.S. established corridor. And when Iran is forced to strike those tankers, then that makes the relationship between Iran and those countries more complicated. And on the other hand, Iran has broken the siege that the Saudis have imposed on Yemen. And they sent a commercial plane to Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. And the Saudi Air Force tried to impede the civilian airliner from landing. And that is a very dangerous thing to do. The plane did land. And the second plane has also gone to Yemen. But it just shows how unstable the situation is when the Saudis, at a time when they're negotiating with the Iranians, they are also helping the Americans undermine the MOU by sending tankers through the strait, or trying to do so, and also by harassing Iranian commercial planes. So things have improved somewhat with some of these countries.
Come back to Professor Barandi for just three more minutes or so. Again, he's based in Tehran and offers some perspective that's hard to find elsewhere. So back to his interview with Pascal Lataz at Neutrality Studies for just a few more minutes here.
At war, but the problem that the United States has is that the shortages that we see across the world are enormous. And we've, for 4 months, the shortages have been growing. And this is not going to go away anytime soon. And so if the United States in the next few months, whether before the midterm elections or after the midterm elections, if they start another war, the speed in which the global economy will move towards a crisis will be much greater than when this war started, because we're already almost there. And as I've seen on your show in discussions with experts, people who are experts in economy, something I have very little knowledge of, and I only listen to these people to have a vague understanding of what's going on. The global economy without the energy crisis is moving towards a very dangerous place anyway. And so I think that if the United States wants to restart a war, the Iranians will be more prepared militarily than before. And the global economy will be much closer to disaster. So I don't think that war will last very long, and I don't think it will lead to any success for the United States. But since Trump is Trump, and since the Zionist lobby and the Israeli regime have enormous influence, while it would sound crazy for the United States to pursue another war, I wouldn't bet on anything.
Right. It's a crazy time for the United States, and they are now weaker than before. Already before, they were weaker than 10 years ago, and now they're even weaker and have even worse cards, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't try to play them anyhow. Maybe very last thing, any observations about the Europeans? Because we are seeing now how the Gulf states send delegations, right? Or at least some of them, how there's negotiations happening in the Gulf. And the Europeans, you could see how they disliked this war, but how they couldn't speak against it since the emperor himself ordered this and they had to brown nose him very badly. And they're brown nosing him right now in Ankara. But at the same time, they're kind of unhappy about it. Did you see any signals, any signs about how Europe is trying to approach Iran from their side?
Well, you know, Pascal, the problem is that the Europeans have no power. They undermine themselves for many years now. And the crisis in Ukraine is growing. And they already have more than enough trouble managing their own affairs. The British Prime Minister, who has no support from the public, is now being forced to leave. He'll be replaced by someone just as unpopular as himself. The French president is despised. The German chancellor is despised. Europe is in a terrible situation. They've destroyed their economy, or they're destroying their economies. And they're moving towards deindustrialization through a series of foolish policies, but also sanctioning the Russians and allowing the Americans under Biden to wreck the relationship between them and Russia. And they did the same basically with Iran. So they've brought this crisis upon themselves.
There again, that's Professor Barandi in Tehran being interviewed on neutrality studies. And he's been an excellent voice, interviewed in many places. So I've got 10 or 15 minutes left here. I want to return to some comments from Professor Robert Pape, whom I referred to earlier, commenting on the Iranian situation, where the three principal actors, of course, are U.S., Israel, and Iran. Professor Pape comments, "None of the three principal actors achieved the political outcome they originally sought. That is why all three continue using force. But one important feature of the strategic landscape has changed. By declaring the memorandum dead and publicly abandoning negotiations, President Trump has tied his own political credibility more directly to the military outcome of the conflict. If the war drags on while oil markets remain under pressure and global energy prices continue rising, the political cost at home will increase rather than diminish. I would say political cost overseas as well. That creates a powerful incentive for Trump to seek a visible military success. The most obvious candidates are Iran's strategic positions around the Strait of Hormuz, including Keshem Island and the Karg Island oil export complex, not because capturing them would end the war, but because they would provoke a concrete demonstration that the United States had regained the strategic initiative. Escalation is no longer being driven solely by Iranian incentives. Washington now has growing political incentives of its own to change the military balance rather than simply manage it." This is explaining why the situation is as dangerous as ever. Final comment from Professor Pape. "Once both sides conclude that the existing balance of power is politically unacceptable, the pressure for larger military operations grows rapidly, even when neither side possesses a clear path to decisive victory. That is how escalation traps become wars that neither side originally intended to fight." So that's, again, Professor Robert Pape, University of Chicago. And I've got a few more comments here, and then if I have time, we'll play one more tape on an interesting international commentator. Here's Larry Johnson. We've quoted him before. He's got his own Substack blog. Your response from Iran, from the Iranian Parliament National Security Committee, was that in any future confrontation, the enemy will face a comprehensive, all-out surprise offensive from the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have many options available that were not even used during the 40-day war. That's the one that started February 28th. Options, again, this is Iranian spokesman, options such as withdrawal from the nuclear NPT treaty, changing the nuclear doctrine, and closing the Bab al-Mandab Strait alongside the Strait of Hormuz are on the table for review. A bill for NPT withdrawal is also ready for review in Parliament. And if Iran faces an existential threat, a change in nuclear doctrine could also be put on the agenda. So here we have my commentary now, the extreme examples of blowback where our aggressive and threatening behavior produces the opposite of what we hoped it would achieve. So the crisis is here. Tankers are not getting through. Europe is running out of natural gas, is running out of armaments, is running low on petroleum. The LNG from the U.S. is three times as expensive. And another comment I picked up in social media, copied from social media, Arab countries are offering aggressive discounts because there are very few ships available to go back into Hormuz to pick up that oil. Until they don't unload their tanks, they cannot restart crude oil production. This is not an oil glut. I'm trying to explain some of the specifics of how we're heading into a big crisis here. All right, one final bit. We have a few minutes left, and Einar Tangen, Einar E-I-N-A-R, and Tangen, T-A-N-G-E-N, don't know too much about his background. He's a Chinese-looking man, quite articulate, and he's interviewed on another great site, which is hosted by Lena Petrova, and it's called World Affairs in Context. Einar Tangen can be found at asiannarratives.substack, and Lena Petrova can be found at patreon.com, Lena Petrova. And I'm going to play a few minutes from their interview, leading up to some fascinating geopolitical considerations and also Chinese strategy.
Or economics are separate areas, but in fact, I think they're so interrelated, and you just sort of highlighted the interconnections that all of us should be able to start noticing. And of course, there's a theory in international relations that the more we develop economic ties, we as nations, as states, the less likely we are to go to war with each other. So I think China is, of course, very much focused on developing economic relations and collaborating with states, regardless of ideology, regardless of their political structure. And I think that is such a difference from what we see in the West. It's very, very different, and it's interesting to see the new dynamic that China is supporting and how it actually benefits the global South, and it benefits China as a state, it benefits its people, and this is a fascinating development. Now, sort of going back to conflicts, your article suggested that geopolitics and finance are becoming inseparable, and that can be seen if we look at the war in Iran. So has the recent Iran conflict accelerated global demand for alternatives to dollar-based payment systems, and has it accelerated demand for the yuan? What is China observing in that regard?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's been a direct consequences. First off, Iran basically said you have to be dealing in renminbi in order to go through the straits. Then they closed the straits. Then the U.S. closed the straits. I don't know who's closing it now. They keep saying that they're going to reopen it. This is 20% of the world's oil. You know, if you go back to the first oil crisis in 73, that involved somewhere between 9-11% of the world's oil, or less. There goes between 7-11%, depending on who you talk to. And that resulted in oil going up by four times.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. This, again, is Einar Tangen, interviewed by Lena Petrova. And let me find the next bit here.
Uh, that stuff that's out there. So China began with this idea that they wanted to build infrastructure. But last year, you heard Xi Jinping talking about it's time we put the framework in. Right. China's put this framework in of ports and roads and things like that. Now they want to color it in. And people say, well, what does color it in mean? So, well, China is not trying to get all nations to buy from them, despite all the rhetoric you hear. They're saying we need to set up industrial development zones, because the way the Chinese see it is if they get countries that are making money and making products, especially those which involve more labor than China can competitively give, they create jobs. Jobs create incomes. Income produces disposable income, and people want to buy stuff. So China sees this as a growing pie, and they want to see more economic development in these countries. So around these ports and airports and roads and things like that, they're starting to fill it in with these industrial development zones, even though things look fairly grim. The fact is China continues to go. And there's this other part. The United States has been pushing this, let's separate, let's de-risk, let's decouple, all of these kind of different words. What does it mean? It's part of the containment policy. But the containment policy doesn't work very well when you're always importing things. The United States in last year imported $4.3 trillion, literally a quarter of what it consumes. You can't replace that, and you're not going to create factories that can work in the United States to replicate that. It doesn't say made in China anymore. It says made in Indonesia or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh or India. But I assure you, the cloth came from China. If it's, let's say, clothing, the zippers came from China, the buttons came from China, even the little tag at the back, that says whatever, that comes from China. All right, so it's assembled somewhere else, but China's still doing production. And people say, well, that's unfair. How did they do that? They must be doing something sneaky. What China did is it didn't have a lot of money. What the industries would concentrate on finding industries that were about economies of scale. These are mature industries, whether it was cloth or toilet paper or whatever. And they said, okay, in Western developed societies, they want 8% return on their money. So we're willing to take 5, 4. Foxconn takes a little over 2% or even less from what I've heard if the contract is big enough. For instance, they do a cost plus contract with Apple. So it's the cost plus whatever the costs are, plus somewhere be in around 2%, a little less, a little more, depending on the product. And that's their thing. That could not happen in the United States, because the banks wouldn't lend you any money. They just say, no, your return isn't great enough. We're afraid something happens and you go bankrupt and you can't repay us back. In China, it's a very different story. So in China, they have a tremendous number of companies that are producing things at very, very low cost, very low margin, and therefore it's hard to compete against them. And so this idea that you're going to replicate that in the United States with higher wage costs, higher land costs, higher construction costs, higher compliance costs, et cetera, just isn't reasonable. And you can't do it because the banks wouldn't lend you the money. And, you will go to your if you go to your shareholders and say, well, I think we can make 2%, they'd be like, no, I need to sell this stock now. Right. So, it's one of those things where China evolved into this role because it was the only place they could go. And now, there's these fears, as I said, basically based on this idea, well, if I had that power, the U.S. said, oh, if we had that power, we would use it. And we would, use it against nations. So they assume everyone else will do the same thing because they have a certain worldview. So that goes back to your observation that economics and outlook and politics are very, very much connected.
There again is Einar Tangen, being interviewed by Lena Petrova, and that's your class on geopolitics for today. Thanks for tuning in. Your host, Dave Gutnick, will be back with Don Olson next week.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
He conceived of the experimental city as a laboratory for urban technology.
This is the trailer to the 2017 documentary, The Experimental City. Seriously, somebody wanted to build a dome city in northern Minnesota? That sounds so Jetsons. A native of South Africa, Athelstan Spilhouse believed in improving life through technology. To that end, in the 1960s, he conceived the Minnesota Experimental City. The city would sprawl over 60,000 acres in Aiken County, Minnesota, under a mammoth geodesic dome. The inhabitants would enjoy self-driving roads, a monorail, modular homes, wilderness areas. Scientists would use the experimental city to devise a better, cleaner mode of living. The cost, the inadequacy,